Welcome to the Program Podcast. The Program is a team building and leadership development company that works with more than 160 collegiate and professional athletic teams and corporations throughout North America annually. And I'm Eric Kapitulik, the founder and CEO of it. The Program believes that individual talent affords us the opportunity to do well in life. Individuals and individual talent wins games. But great teams compete for championships on whatever our chosen battlefield may be. And great teams are comprised of great teammates and great leaders. Joining me today on the Program Podcast to help us become great teammates and leaders is Admiral Sandy Stowes. Admiral Stowes is an experienced senior leader who has served and operated in the military, maritime, homeland security, transportation, and academic sectors. Her expertise includes leadership development, strategic vision and planning, change management, training and education, and leading and managing complex organizations. She started out in the Coast Guard as an ensign, serving on polar icebreakers, conducting national security missions from the Arctic to the Antarctic. Her 36-year career was filled with leadership lessons gleaned while breaking ice and breaking glass. As the first woman to command an icebreaker on the Great Lakes and to lead a U.S. Armed Forces Service Academy, the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut, where she was responsible for developing and educating a corps of 1,000 cadets. She finished her career as the first woman assigned as Deputy Commandant for Mission Support, directing one of the Coast Guard's largest enterprises. She was responsible for all facets of support for the Coast Guard's diverse mission, set through oversight of human capital, life cycle engineering and logistics, acquisitions, information technology, training and education, and security. She is a graduate of the Coast Guard Academy with a Bachelor of Science degree in government. She also has earned a Master of Business Administration from Northwestern University's Kellogg Graduate School of Management and a Master of National Security Strategy from the National War College. Admiral Stowe's military awards include 2 Coast Guard Distinguished Service Medals, 3 Legion of Merit Medals, and 4 Meritorious Service Medals. She is the recipient of the National Maritime Historical Society Distinguished Service Award, Soldiers, Sailors, Marines, Coast Guardmen, and Airmen's Club Distinguished Military Leadership Award, Girl Scouts of America Trailblazer Award, and the Connecticut Woman of the Year Award. Newsweek's The Daily Beast named her as one of 150 women who shake the world. She is the author of Breaking Ice and Breaking Glass, Leading in Uncharted Waters. In it, Vice Admiral Stowes draws upon her 40 years of extensive experience and wisdom as a woman directing mostly all-male teams in frontline leadership positions to provide tools that will help leaders, particularly those at the middle level, reach their goals and succeed. Admiral, thank you so much for joining me and us today.
Well, Eric, thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be here today on your podcast.
Admiral, how does someone go from, by your own admission, struggled as a shy introvert to become the first female superintendent of the United States Service Academy?
Well, I will tell you, Eric, it's a journey. It's a journey of self-discovery. It's a journey of many years. And I was just yesterday down in Baltimore at a symposium sponsored by the American Society of Naval Engineers. And I was working with some cadets and junior officers and trying to convey to them that I was in their shoes at one point 40 years ago, and that you start out a bit unconfident and shy in some cases like I did, and you don't become overnight an admiral. You weren't born an admiral. And I think a lot of people look at a senior officer, a senior executive in business, and they just see that person for what they are that day, that moment, and think, oh, they were born that way. No, a lot of us were born with things we had to overcome. And I, yes, was shy, was unconfident. I am an introvert, and I've learned to leverage that as a benefit, as opposed to a handicap, because I think it can be hard to be an introvert in what could be called an extrovert's world. So I was able to become the person I needed to be to achieve the goals I wanted to achieve. So yeah, did I have to change a little bit along the way and grow in my confidence? Yes. And how did I do that? Because you have to find a way. And this is all about leading yourself and learning how to lead yourself, the self-discovery. It's learning through hard work, hard knocks, perseverance, choosing to do the hard things, choosing to get out of your comfort zone. I found that through two vectors. One was sports and athletics, and one was academics. And I chose to challenge myself to do things hard. When all the other kids were out partying or having a good time, I was inside studying or I was out practicing in the swimming pool or on the track field to become better and to push myself. And I think that's how I first started to become a more confident young person. It was through academics and athletics, pushing myself to do something hard and persevering, not giving up, learning how to continue pushing through even when it was painful and you were giving up other things and you were being judged by other people who tried to use peer pressure to pull you away. Why are you working so hard when the rest of us are having a good time? So I'll leave it at that because I don't want to dominate the conversation, because it was a whole lifetime journey of choosing to do something hard to get out of my comfort zone. So continually staying on my toes to try to become better as opposed to being comfortable with being good enough.
Yeah, well, Adam, listening to you speak, it reminds me of, people may see, they might see me now and be like, oh, of course Eric was a Marine, right? Yeah, but they didn't see me when I was 16 years old. And listening to you speak, I feel like probably, and again, I don't know if this is the case, but I feel this way. I met you and I'm like, oh, of course Sandy's Admiral in the Coast Guard. But I didn't see you when you were 16 years old, right? Now, with that said, nature versus nurture in Breaking Ice and Breaking Glass, which I want to get to here and talk in depth with you, you highlighted and you talked about your family, your parents and your brothers. And nature and nurture. And I think about myself and why did I go to the Naval Academy? My question to you is going to be, why did you choose the Coast Guard Academy, right? Because I think about that. And I just remember being in high school, building stone walls with our wrestling coach in high school. Now, I'm not tough enough to wrestle, but I worked with our wrestling coach in high school. We built stone walls by hand. And I remember building a stone wall. We couldn't move this huge stone. And he said, hey, the heck with it. Let's wait till tomorrow. We'll deal with it tomorrow morning. Well, I went home that night and I couldn't sleep. So late at night, I drove my bike back to this stone wall. And he ended up showing up the following day. And it was like Pinocchio, right? The stone was back in place where it had to be. And he was like, how did this happen? You know, and I was like, hey, look, I couldn't let that stone beat me. And so I told him the story. Fast forward, he ended up writing my admission essay to the Naval Academy, the teacher essay about why the Naval Academy should select Eric Kapitulik. And subsequently, I had the director of admissions say, hey, you should thank, this gentleman's name was Hagop Merzhan. You should thank your college counselor for getting you into the Naval Academy, for building stone walls with him. I've never forgotten it, right? Mm-hmm. Now tell me, Admiral, when you were the 16-year-old, not Admiral Stowes, when you were the 16-year-old Sandy, why did you choose the Naval Academy? Do you think it was nature? Was it just nurture? Did you already have that feeling of, hey, I'm going to do challenging things? What?
So I love the way you frame that in terms of nurture or nature, because it reminds me of another argument on whether leaders are born or made. So there's that kind of aligns with this thought on whether you have any agency and control over your own outcomes and eventual success. And I think it's a combination of both. I say this in my book about leaders being born or made. I think it's a combination of both, being nurtured or nature. I think it's a combination of both. So when I was 16, I had been, I guess nurtured would be put through the ropes of some challenging times as a young person. In my book, I talk about, you know, little things, nothing like what you've done. I was listening to your episode with Chris Ward a couple of days ago. Oh my God, she's climbed the 14 peaks in the world that are above 8,000 meters. When I was 12 years old, climbed Mount Washington with my father, 2 week camping trip with my brothers. But I have a little story I made out of that because it was a challenge for a 12-year-old.
Yes,
and
yes.
That helped build me, nurture me into the leader I eventually became. My parents establishing core values that they demanded of us, honesty and humility, hard work and perseverance, and my four core values that got me through, that I learned as a child from my parents and my coaches, and that made me the leader of character that I became. I always say that your core values are the foundation of your character, and your character determines the kind of leader you're going to become. So between my...
Can you say that one more time, Sandy?
Yes.
That's key.
Core values, your core values, and I have four: honesty, humility, hard work, perseverance. They're the foundation of what your character is, and your character determines the kind of leader you're going to become, the kind of leader person you're going to become. So it all starts with core values. So the nurture started with parents and coaches instilling core values in me. And part of that hard work and perseverance came with that climbing the mountain. The honesty and humility came from other vectors, but that's the nurture. And then the nature, I think, came in. Even though I was shy and quiet, I was also stubborn. So I had, and I think every human has counterbalancing characteristics, traits, and they need to be have enough emotional intelligence and self-awareness to understand that. So if you just say, well, I was a shy, somewhat unconfident 16-year-old, you'll never get past that. If you say, oh, but I was also determined and nobody was going to push me around, then I would quietly smolder inside and then go and prove them wrong, right? So whenever someone told me, you can't do that because you're not good enough, fast enough, strong enough, good enough looking, I would become very quiet and then I would go around and I would show them how they were wrong. Maybe that's a little bit like that stone. It wasn't showing somebody they were wrong, but you were proving to yourself you could do it. Same thing with being stubborn. I'm proving to myself that they're not right, that I can do this. I might not have the confidence to tell them to their face, but I'm going to go around and show them. To arguing, I'm going to show them what I can do. So I think that when it came time to pick a college, I was a beneficiary of where opportunity intersects with talent and passion. And the service academies were all required to open their doors to women by the National Defense Authorization Act of 1975, which went into effect in 1976, when the first class of women were admitted to all the Armed Forces Service Academies. And that followed on the Title IX in 1972, which originally was designed to offer opportunities to women and girls in education and sports, and then the Equal Rights Amendment in 73. So it was a cascade of opportunities for young women like me, who was born in 1960 and a beneficiary of all these opportunities that hadn't been there for other women. So a neighbor brought over to my mom an article in the Baltimore Sun, and I was born and raised near Baltimore. And it was all a feature article on the Naval Academy right down the road in Annapolis and how they're accepting women. And oh, by the way, here's just all about the Naval Academy. Go to sea, have adventure. You get to sail, and it's a free education, which in the mid 70s was a big deal during the oil shock that we were having at the time. And so I went ahead and applied to the Naval Academy because my nature was for adventure too. So even though I was shy and unconfident, I loved the thought of an adventure, going out to sea on a sailboat, sailing to unknown lands. It just captured my imagination. I always liked to read books, and reading a book, I could, you know, transport myself to where this book was being written and the characters in it. So my guidance counselor, who had been my swim coach, he said to me, Sandy, you can't put all your eggs in one basket, because I was going through the Naval Academy nomination. I got my nomination from Senator Sarbanes, But he said, my guidance counselor, you've got to apply, cast a wider net. So he said, look, I got this flyer from this place called the Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut. So we pored over that flyer, and between the two of us, we decided, well, the Coast Guard's a small Navy. So I'll apply as a backup. Well, of course, the Coast Guard is not a small Navy, and we're far from it. We have a lot of different missions. We probably don't have time to go into that now. But we certainly work with the Navy a lot, and with the Marine Corps, all the sea services, the Merchant Marine. So I apply to the Naval, to the Coast Guard Academy as a backup. Well, I hear back really quickly, and I'm admitted, or I'm given an offer of acceptance. And my mother said, you should take that bird in the hand when you got it. And because meanwhile, the Naval Academy, even though I had a nomination from Senator Sarbanes, I'm slogging through the appointment process. And so maybe this is the nature part. I wanted to take that bird in hand and just get that decision made and start moving forward with my life. And oh my goodness, what a coincidence, a providential, call it what you want. But the Coast Guard, when they opened their doors to women, their senior leadership decided to not put any restrictions on the women coming in, when all the other academies and services did put the restrictions on for combat exclusion. And who's to judge whether that's right or wrong, but the Coast Guard didn't. So when I was a young cadet, I was sailing for a summer cruise on one of the Coast Guard's 378-foot ships, the size of a small frigate. And we had Harpoon Seaways missile systems on there and ready to go to war if the call came. But we didn't have any restrictions. And I really think that made it easier for women to assimilate into the Coast Guard. We didn't have that judgment that, well, you were restricted, you can't do anything. So therefore the women graduates from the Naval Academy get all the good shore jobs and the men get resentful. And I think if you treat people differently, have double standards, it causes resentment. It makes it harder to integrate. The Coast Guard made it easier, much easier to integrate women by giving them equal opportunity and access from the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. You said something about proving others wrong, right? Hey, I'm going to show you, know? And that's funny. I felt that way in high school too, but coupled with that, and I think this has been true throughout my entire life, that's part of it. I think the greater part was maybe proving myself right rather than, so like I've got that little question mark of, hey, am I good enough? Am I tough enough to do X, Y, or Z? And that little bit of nervousness, I just didn't want that fear to rule me. I think, and I use that with my kids today when coaching about, how do we frame, and I think this is a nice segue into talking to you about breaking ice and breaking glass, because you mentioned this in your book, is let's define what success means. Let's, and by the flip side of that, define what failure means. Like, failure may not mean losing. Failure does not mean falling short. Are you getting in the arena, right? Type of thing. So as I hear you speak, that really was driven home to me. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I just wrote that down. Proving others wrong versus proving yourself right. I do a blog every 2 weeks on Leading with Character. That might be a blog topic because it's two sides of the same coin.
It is.
Yeah. And we have it to consider them both together, or we're always going to be trying to prove others wrong and being resentful maybe against them as opposed to looking at what we can do to prove ourselves right. Because a lot of the discontent resides within our own self. And our attitude is key to purging that discontent and becoming a satisfied, confident person.
Yeah, exactly. And to be clear, when I say prove myself right, I think one of the real issues our country has now, and I think social media fosters this, is too many people yelling and screaming, trying to prove themselves right, meaning I'm going to try to prove myself right to you. And I mean it, I'm trying to prove myself right to me, right? Like, I feel like, trying to prove myself right to you is pretty immature, right? Like, what am I trying to prove myself right to you? I'll talk to you about my feelings about things, and I hope you do the same. And by communicating with each other, we can gain a better understanding of each other. But I'm doing that to gain a better understanding, not some sort of immature prove myself right or have a need. When I say prove myself right, and I know you understand this, is to myself, which is the most important person. Right.
That's exactly what I meant too. But you know what, though? A lot of people, if you wrote a blog about that, they would think it the other way. They would think it was you kind of force your views on them, because that's how our society is wired now. Now, you and I both mean proving ourselves that we can put that stone on the fence, or proving to ourselves that we can get into the Coast Guard Academy, even though it's hard. We're going to show you that we have what it takes. That's what it means to prove ourselves right.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's great. So, let's talk about, and for our audience, I'll talk about it at the end here. You've got to go. If you want to be, if you are a leader in a leadership role, in a position of authority, if you want to be a better leader and a better teammate, you've got to read the Admiral's book in Breaking Ice and Breaking Glass. We are only going to be able to, and I only want to be able to talk about parts of it today so that more people do read your book, because it's awesome, Admiral. In it, you discuss your framework for leadership development, leading self and leading others, leading programs and making policy, and leading the organization. All right, easy question. Tell us how we do all three in less than 30 seconds. Go. No, I'm just kidding. Can you talk about, let's break each one down and maybe take what you think is the mission critical point of each.
So leading self
and leading others.
Leading self and leading others. And by the way, I took this framework from the Coast Guard's framework for leader development, and I modified it to fit my book. I wanted my book to be in three parts. So leading self and leading others, it gets right to, I've listened to a few of your podcasts, Eric, and it gets right to this whole thing about the team. So leading yourself, you need to learn how to find your own purpose, your own core values, self-discovery of what your passions might be, what interests you, what you're good at, what you're not good at. This whole self-discovery that you see young people going through, and young teenagers, they're often confused for good reason. They've got so many choices and options. They're trying to figure out who they really are first. That's a grounding requirement. So there's a lot of skills that come with leading yourself, followership, you know, how to be a good follower first before you can really think about giving orders or leading somebody else. How do you follow correctly? How do you be on time? How do you do what you're supposed to do? How do you adhere to standards? How do you follow the rules? How do you set your own goals, right? Leading others, this is where you now become part of a team. So it's not just about you and figuring out what's good for you, what you are good at, but now, wait a minute, how do I connect with these teammates? Oh, there's arguments and controversy here. I think some of the elements of that are, you take there's personality tests. There's one called the DISC, D-I-S-C, that's a personality test designed for teams, where you can find out what your personality is and you share those constructs with each other. And then you're like, okay, that guy or gal's not a jerk. They're just this kind of personality type. They're intense, they're focused, they need to get it done now. And on this dreamy person who just wants to take time, lay it all out there, consider everything, get everybody's input. So this guy here is just wired different. It's not that he's trying to be abrasive, right? Mm-hmm. So this whole thing about leading self and leading others is about the individual and the team and how they connect to become more powerful than just the individual pieces, where the sum of all of them is the most powerful part. There's a saying about that that doesn't come to mind right now, but something that's stronger than the individual pieces, members of the team.
Right. Yes.
When you've got a really good cohesive team, you are far stronger than just the sum of each individual on that team. And there's a magic there that all of us who've been part of a high performing team understand. And I know that's part of the business you're in, but that's what my leading self and leading others first stage of the framework is. And then I think that the leading change and leading policies, this is what is important to me, this middle section of my book, because so many people.
Admiral, could I stop you though first? Because there was one part that I really wanted, before we move on to that second section, that while reading your book, it was funny because, so for our audience, Admiral Stowes and I met each other at, we were both speaking at a conference down in Savannah, Georgia. And I spoke first, I was the opening act, and the Admiral was the main draw here. She was the closer. Okay. But, Admiral, when I was speaking, and I know you came, I was very, very fortunate to have you come, really appreciate it. When I was speaking to the audience, I feel like after reading your book, you probably were sitting there thinking, has this guy like plagiarized me? Right? Because you talk about a lot of things. In fact, you call them very similarly, some of the same things that we do at the program. And when leading self and leading others, and you've already spoken about it today, where you talk about figuring out what your core values are and the importance of it, right? And boy, it's the bedrock of ourselves individually and then as a team. You then went on to talk about one thing that when describing your own life, about how do you come from shy introvert 16-year-old Sandy Stowes to vice admiral, first woman to lead a U.S. service academy. It struck me, and again, you wrote about it in your book, and I'd love you to comment on it, about commit to lifelong learning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Yeah, and of it.
Oh my gosh. And I did mention earlier in this podcast that I love to read from a young age. And I believe that everyone's heard the phrase that leaders are readers. Yeah, I think you really have to be a consumer of information and literature to become a leader, a better leader, an even better leader. So it gets back to that nurture and nature. So the nurturing part is lifelong learning. And the best role models, mentors, and leaders that I know are leaders who are readers. And I'll just name, I'll throw out two of them right there. One was Admiral Thad Allen, who was the Commandant of the Coast Guard, who I served as his executive assistant. He was constantly talking about lifelong learning. And then the other was General Jim Mattis, who endorsed my book. And he's constantly talking about lifelong learning and has an exceptionally broad repertoire of a library of what he's read. And that he's open about that in his book, about how those, going back to those readings that you can do from all the way back from the Stoics onwards, helped him to fight and make decisions on the battlefield. So we have to be readers. And whether that reading is in the traditional sense of reading professional journals and good books, not just leadership books, but good novels where you can relate to the characters, but also reading in the context of listening now, when you have so much with podcasts and online programming that you can get. I use Great Courses. It's a program that you can download courses and learn about things you never would have thought you could learn about, 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So lifelong learning is key to us developing into the leader of character we need to be. We owe it to our people, if we're a leader, to become even better through reading. If you don't put the effort in to continue a lifelong learning, it's not for you. So for people who are like, well, I don't need to read, I'm busy, it's not for you. It's for the people you lead. That's what you're doing. That's who you're doing it for when you're committing to lifelong learning. You're making a commitment to being a better leader, a more learned leader who's up on principles of leadership, the latest thoughts on what they can do to improve their own leadership style. So I know that you could talk about lifelong learning for an entire session, but maybe that's just a few thoughts to get the conversation going.
Yeah. One other point that I'd love to hear your thoughts on and highlight your remarks from the book, because it's something that here we believe in at the program. And I feel like a lot of people are don't, and that we would be better teammates and better leaders if we, in your words, sustained wellness, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And I never thought about wellness in my earlier years in the Coast Guard. We worked really hard. I was at sea for 12 years, and I have to say, after a lot of years of arduous jobs, not just at sea, but even my shore jobs were very challenging. It was when I was commanding a ship post 9/11, the events of September 11th, off the coast of New England. I was down doing security patrols off of Ambrose Light, which is the entrance to New York Harbor, after 9/11. And that was arduous because there was no game book or drill card, whatever analogy you want to use, for what to do in this situation where we knew we had a potential threat to America. We were in a heightened maritime security alert condition for months afterwards, and people were being worn out with the operations tempo being so demanding. And there was no one saying, hey, back off a little bit, you're working too hard. It was up to the captain of the ship, in my case, to control the operations tempo. And normally there's a lot of other factors out there, that there's policies and procedures and op plans, operations plans that govern your mission. Well, there really were not so many, but they were being built on the fly. So a ship like us off the entrance to New York Harbor was trying to board like every merchant vessel coming into the port, because the thought was, well, the bad guys hit us from the air and knocked down the Twin Towers on 9/11, but maybe the next thing is to bring a dirty bomb in by a cargo container ship into the port of New York and blow it up at the port. And imagine what would happen if you had blown up a port with all the commerce. Look how bad it was when we had the supply chain delays during the COVID. Imagine if you had torn up a port for months that had to be rebuilt, and all the damage that would come from a dirty bomb explosion in New York Harbor. So it was a stressful, frightening thought of what could happen. And we were being pressed to do everything we could to board as many vessels as we could day and night with a crew fairly minimally manned. So at one point in time, as the captain of the ship, a couple months into this situation, I started to realize, hey, this is I've got to step back, because I was getting consumed into this tunnel that we all in operational environments can get consumed into, the firefight in your case, Eric, or in my case, the conditions I'm describing, where you just get wound down tighter and tighter into the operational details, and you lose sight of the bigger picture, which was the crew is becoming exhausted, and my training is becoming is degrading, my maintenance, I'm going to have a major casualty on the ship and then we'll be dead in the water and useless to nobody. So I realized I owed it to my crew and to the Coast Guard to get the mission done. I had to step back and look at where I had to focus. And I decided that I had to focus on a balance, like a three-legged stool: operations, training, slant maintenance, and crew rest. And all we were doing was operations. So we were pushing everything there and letting everything else fall by the wayside. And so I called the crew together on the mess deck, talked to my officers first, and said, look, I'm telling you, because everybody wanted to be doing as much as they could, even if they were exhausted, we're going to start to balance this. And we're going to do boardings, in a more, measured way. We're going to get back to our training, get back to our maintenance, and we're going to get the crew some rest. And everything settled out after that. We're able to do the longer haul, long-term mission where we were going to burn out. So that started me thinking about burnout. So this now, that was a predecessor, Eric, to your question about how to manage burnout. So that's how I managed burnout on that ship, just to give you an idea of that three-legged stool.
Yeah.
of balancing everything instead of letting it go one way and not having anybody call the ball on that. And the only one who's going to call the ball on that is the CO, the commanding officer. And I heard one of your podcasts, it's lonely to be at the top in leadership. There's no one to ask for advice. And you can lean on your crew, ask your officers and chiefs and use all those resources. But at the end of the day, it's a lonely place to be at the top. So I come up with an idea for how to help people wherever their circumstance was, where there's exhaustion, either of the unit, the team, or the individual, to look at it in terms of levers. There's I think four kinds of exhaustion, and people could argue this more or less. Physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. People don't ever talk about the spiritual side because maybe it's taboo or something, but we all have a spiritual component. We don't have to be religious people or be pushing our religion on somebody to acknowledge that there's a spiritual component to all of us. So a lot of us think of exhaustion as physical, just get more rest, and we can never quite get caught up. If you look at it as levers you can pull, you're never going to be completely exhausted and depleted physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. You have control if you're physically exhausted to, sure, take some rest, balance out the other measures. Maybe you, if you're physically exhausted, you you take a spiritual break and you get aside and do some thinking. You read a good book, you do some meditation, whatever works for you. I've had all kinds of experience with this, the spiritual side. I think it's very powerful. If you're emotionally exhausted and depleted, maybe you go for a run and you get into that runner's high and you just let it all go. And so I think knowing how to balance those levers and understand there's lots of different kinds of stress your body is going through and exhaustion, you're never depleted all in one area. So where can you lean in that that matrix of different levers to energize, to drive some energy in there? And I think if you look at it that way, then you are going to not, you're going to be able to fight the exhaustion and depletion, and you're going to be able to get better wellness for you and your team.
Yeah, for sure. Great. Let's talk about the second part of your framework, leading programs and making policy. And it's a big topic and an interesting one, but I really liked talking about how to succeed in an organization. Admiral, I think that and the question is, being a woman in a heavily male dominated organization like any one of our services, but I don't think it's that different than my wife used to work in finance. It was, I think she would describe it as heavily male dominated as well. And I think there's I'm going to ask you the question, but there's probably similarities to, from one male heavily dominated organization to another. When we talk about succeeding in an organization, what advice do you have for women and for all of us?
So that's a whole podcast in and of itself.
Yeah.
So I would say that, you know, if you look at my book, there is that triangle of how to succeed, the success pyramid, I call it. I kind of stole that from John Wooden, the famous basketball coach. Yes. The bottom of the pyramid is the societal rules and laws and regulations that they benefited me. I talked about that earlier in the podcast with laws like Title IX, Equal Rights Amendment, the National Defense Authorization Act that gave access. And then once women get access to an organization, whether it's financial services or whether it's the military, then that organization needs to take those incoming women and include them through policies and programs that integrate and include them, right? Because you need that. It's something new and it doesn't happen overnight. So it not only takes the programs and policy, it takes the enforcement. It takes the hot wash and the follow-up. I heard one of your podcasts where you talked about follow-up being so important and you know, hot washing events and happenings.
Debriefing them.
Debriefing is the word you used. We use hot wash and the
Yeah, we do too. But yeah, it's for our audience. We by hot wash we mean a debrief. Yeah,
debrief exactly.
Yeah, what went well? What needs? What can we do better?
So there's that bottom pyramid of access, the policy, the law and the regulations. And there's the middle part of the pyramid, which is the organization now has to lean in with policy and programs that integrate and include women. But then at the top of the pyramid, there's the personal component. And this is where the person is responsible in their own way for fitting in with that organization, for reaching out their hand to ask how they can be included, to help the organization to find ways to include them, and to use their core values, their strengths, their own personal agency as part of the success. So too often nowadays, people abdicate their personal agency. There's this whole victim mentality. So yes. People are looking to blame the organization, blame the society. No, the society and the organization are doing things. Instead of blaming, you need to see what you can do to be part of the solution, and not just be a complaining person who abdicates responsibility and points fingers. So that kills me when I see that happening, because this victim mentality is not going to last long. It's having its heyday right now, maybe for a while, but it's not a sustainable strategy to be a victim. No. You've got to be somebody with personal agency. So that's at the top of the pyramid. I believe that's how I succeeded, because the society gave me access. The organization gave me lots of opportunities. They integrated me. They did a great job. But then it was really up to me. And yeah, there were always, Eric, people in that pyramid who try to bring you down, who aren't advocating for you. Just like there's people mentoring for you and advocating, there's others who aren't. And do you really need to listen to them? Or can you just say that I have the personal agency to not listen to what they're saying, to just let it go? Otherwise, I could be eaten up by what other people are saying or some one person. So you see that so much now, is that somebody has a problem with one person or one element, and they blame the whole organization or say this is not a good culture for women. So I've always found ways to use my own personal agency. And I have a whole talk on the power of being different. And I won't hog up the podcast with it, but I've got a lot of examples of how I came in as the first and sometimes only woman on a ship with 150 men. Yeah. And I was able to harness the power of being different to succeed and to help the whole unit to become better. And I think that's just an incredible fact that not many people acknowledge. Yeah. They haven't had the opportunities that I have had to be in those positions and help be part of that change. But maybe by my stories, I can let people know it's possible to find the power in being different.
Yeah. Admiral, I get asked this question, and I kind of always chuckle to myself about concerning the military. And I think maybe, I don't know why, but maybe a fair number of people think the military is, there's rampant sexism and racism. And in my experiences, which I know it's just my experience, okay, it's my truth. That doesn't mean it's the truth. And on top of it, as you can tell, I am a white male. And also I happen to be in something called the Marine Corps, and I happen to be 6 feet tall and 210 pounds and in shape. So when people talk about, sexism or racism, I'm like, oh no, I didn't see any. I don't think there is any. Right now, I know that's a very parochial answer. Just because in my experience, I didn't witness any, it doesn't mean there isn't. But I always felt like, if anything, the military really showed me, I feel like the military was like decades ahead from a race and sex perspective, where, I mean, 30 years ago, if somebody made a racist comment, as you were kicked out of the military, like next day, but again, that's my experience, and I'm a white male, right? How about yourself? What are your feelings about that? I mean, you're the only woman on a Coast Guard ship. I mean, you talk about different. That's different. What are your thoughts about that? I just wanted to know personally.
So like you, I have what my experience has been. I really stay away from that whole my truth thing because boy, have I seen people exploit that. And when they say my truth, they mean the truth. And there is only one truth. I hate to say it, but there's only one truth for any given situation. There might be lots of people who've experienced different things. There's only one truth. I mean, the sun comes up every day. You can't argue with that, even though it might be cloudy. So I have experienced very little of these concerning behaviors in my 40 years in the Coast Guard and coming in 1978 and then to the Coast Guard Academy. Generally speaking, very, very positive experiences. And I found that everybody has it hard. It wasn't just the women at the academy, for instance, or women who were junior officers. There were men who were awkward, or they weren't exactly the ones who were the popular guys who fit in. They had a Southern accent, or they had something that people, you know, would josh them about. Yes. Or whatever. So I always thought that lots of people have things that make them different. And I was just trying to look at my experience as the Coast Guard was great. They went out of their way to accommodate women. Were there individuals here and there who didn't have the core values that we demanded? Sure. And they weren't, that's not to be tolerated. We have Coast Guard core values of honor, respect, and devotion to duty. And if somebody doesn't abide with those core values, they need to change, or there's no place in the Coast Guard for them. There's no place in the Coast Guard for people who don't respect their fellow Coast Guard men and women and who harass or assault, abuse them in any way. But I never experienced these problems on the early ships I was on, where it was all women, all men, and very few women.
I think, you know, you said people speaking about the military, and it's something that we talk about a lot with our clients. They're always amazed that somebody sexually assaults somebody else and the commanding officer gets fired from their job for that occurring. I think a lot of people go, wait, well, why does he get fired? Why does she get fired when they didn't do anything? It's one of their people who did it. And we always highlight that in my experiences, where those incidents occur, it's because of poor leadership. The leader did not accurately, quickly enough, hold people to the organization's core values. They let it slide and nothing happens. And then nothing happens. And then nothing. Yeah, but then one day something happens. And yes, that individual did something wrong, but it's a failure in leadership. It's the environment the leader created for that issue to occur very often.
Yep.
Admiral, let's...
Standards and our core values, they need to be upheld, and they can't just be a plaque on a wall, right? And too
That's
often,
right.
They're a plaque on the wall, and the actual enforcement is really hard. Why? Because oftentimes the people who are going against those core values or the standards, not abiding by the standards, are some of your best performers. And people are like, well, we'll just look away. We don't want to have that tough conversation. Maybe that person's having a stressful day or whatever. That's just unacceptable. But I've found that the times where I've, as a senior leader, tried to held people accountable, you're often the one people are judging because you're holding accountable a popular person who people want you to overlook their misbehavior, misconduct, or low performance. And no one else has called them out on this. You're the first one to come in this job who's call this person out. So maybe it's your problem, not the person's problem. Nobody else has cared that this person has misbehaved or underperformed. Well, they just haven't wanted to approach the person and deal with the consequences of holding this popular person accountable, who's going to then rally their network and talk about how they're being mistreated. They're going to file their EEO complaints and everything else. Nobody wants to touch that. So the behavior goes unquestioned time after time. And I've relieved commands where I've had to deal with that first thing a couple different times.
For sure. And ultimately, and you talked about it earlier about having personal agency and the antithesis of the victim's mindset of blaming other people and other things is courage. And you mentioned earlier, having courage to be different. That we know what's right is right, wrong is wrong, based on our core values and our standards. And now the courage to hold people to those core values, hold people to those standards. And we make excuses for not doing so. And not only does it hurt our organization as a whole, by failing to hold somebody accountable when they're not meeting the standard, who else does it hurt? It hurts all the other members of your team, of which most of them are meeting the standard. And we choose not to do it. We have to be better than that as leaders.
Absolutely. And we owe it to our people. And the standard you walk by is the standard you accept. That's the new standard. And if you keep on walking by standards, people will keep on violating with even more greater and greater violations, and then that becomes the standard, and pretty soon it's grossly out of line. But then when you hold them accountable, it's like, well, but it's I haven't done anything wrong because no one's held them accountable yet. And so they've been conditioned now by poor leadership, lack of moral courage, to think that their behavior is acceptable. Even though they know it's wrong inside, it's become acceptable by the fact that the leaders have walked past the standard.
That's right. The final question, and then I'll let you go. In the third part of your framework, leading the organization, I really struggled because I don't know if it was probably every single chapter I was thinking, oh, this is mission critical. Oh, this is mission critical. Developing a vision and strategic intent, the art of decision making. you talk about the being nice illusion. What was some of the impediments to decision making? I was like, yes, mission critical. Yes, mission critical. Yes. So, Admiral, I'm going to leave it up to you. Can you tell somebody who's currently leading an organization, about to take over an organization, that organization could be your family, your classroom, your school, your company. I'll leave it up to you. What's one thing that you think, hey, mission critical? Make sure we do this one thing.
Well, I will give you my definition of leadership, which I gave a lot of thought to. And there's a lot of good definitions of leadership out there, which is why leadership is, I think, so studied, so talked about, because it's not really necessarily something that's got an exact definition. But my definition of leadership is motivating different people to unite around a shared purpose to get the job done. So motivating different people, that means, you know, people of different personalities, different perspectives, experiences, demographically different, to unite, not divide, to unite around a shared purpose to get the job done. So where does that shared purpose and motivation come from? Well, it comes from a leader who has a vision. So the first element of leadership that I think is indisputable, you can't get away without having a vision for where the organization, the team needs to go. And then though, to make that vision happen, you've got to be able to make decisions. And I was so frustrated most of my career in the Coast Guard, seeing leaders who just wouldn't make a decision. And there's three impediments to decision-making are the paralysis by analysis, where the person just won't make a decision because surely tomorrow one more piece of information will come in to make me make a better decision. Well, no, you got to be like the old saying during World War II that a good decision made today is far superior to a perfect decision made next week when it's too late, right?
Right.
That process by analysis, you got to go with an 80% solution and you owe it to your people. And then second one, consensus conundrum, where the leader doesn't want to make a decision because the person wants full consensus. Well, no, there's C words that are great, like communication, collaboration, cooperation. But when it comes to consensus, the tough trade-off decisions do not get made with consensus. They get made and someone's going to be it's going to be tough for decision, resource impacts or whatever. And then the third is the being nice syndrome, where the person just can't make a decision because they know that it'll affect somebody and that person will be, lose something and they'll be upset. And so the person just makes no decision. So, so vision, decision-making, and then I would say, motivating different people. The person has to have emotional intelligence. They have to be the kind of leader who understands themselves, getting back to the self-discovery, knowing who you are, knowing how to be a follower before you know how to be a leader. So that when you become this leader, setting a vision, making decisions, you have the emotional intelligence to understand your people, to motivate them so that you're the leader they follow because they want to, not because they have to. And that's the real indicator of whether you're a good leader, if your people will follow you because they want to and not because they have to.
Yeah. I talk about paralysis by analysis. Admiral, when serving in the Marines, I had a team leader who once told me, "Sir, you don't often make the right decision, but I'll tell you what, you make a decision." And I was thinking, and I thought, I was like, thank you. Is that a, I don't know if that's a compliment in there or what, but for sure. Admiral, the program in this podcast mission is to develop great teammates and leaders to create world-class teams. Sandy, mission accomplished. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your wisdom and leadership lessons you have learned through your storied career.
Thank you for having me, Eric. It's been a real pleasure today, and I hope that we have helped other people become better leaders of character.
For our audience, for more information about Admiral Stowes and to buy her book, which I strongly recommend for all leaders, go to sandrastowes.com. That's Sandra, S-A-N-D-R-A, Stowes, S-T-O-S-Z.com. Our book, The Program, Lessons from Elite Military Units for Creating and Sustaining High-Performance Leaders and Teams, can be found at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. To sign up to receive our monthly letter on leadership or to learn more about the program and our leadership development services for your own team, go to theprogram.org. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at theprogram.org and on LinkedIn at theprogram LLC. Finally, if you've enjoyed today's program podcast, please leave a review of it on whatever platform you have accessed it from. Thank you, and attack.